Stockton versus ARS National. Now, these cases are closely related, so we don't want to hear the same point being repeated over and over again. If you don't have anything new to say, you can just, you know.
I kind of knew that, Your Honor. I was planning on that. In fact, I'm David Phillips. I'm arguing the next three cases, and I would like to save this panel some time, give you kind of my game plan on the three sets of cases. In Captain ARS, I want to focus on your questions about the attorney exemption that was carved out here. As to the settlement offer issue in both Captain ARS and the Every Group of cases, I would defer any argument because if I can't win the Jackson Group of cases, then there's no point in winning the settlement issue on the 12B6 motion because I developed all the evidence I was going to get, did surveys, and if I can't win there, there's no point in winning on a technicality and getting sent back to lose a different way.
Okay, that's a sensible way to proceed.
I try to be right twice a day just like a broken clock, Your Honor, and I guess I got my first moment there. Let's look at what Your Honors were concerned about. People were arguing about congressional intent and trying to make the statute better and that the statute's just designed to protect consumers. That's not correct. The congressional intent in Section 1692 D.E. is it's the purpose of this title to eliminate abusive debt collection practices by debt collectors, to ensure that those debt collectors who refrain from using abusive debt collection practices are not competitively disadvantaged, and to promote consistent state action to protect consumers. So it's much broader than just protecting consumers, and there's this learned intermediary that's going to protect them somehow. The harm is in the illegal statement or the illegal action that's been prohibited. Now, whether that harm then damages the consumer, that's a different issue. In Captain ARS, there were two issues that involved this attorney exemption deal. One was a false statement saying, this isn't paid, there's a $15 a day charge. The second was, that's alleged to be in a Section 1692E violation. E is the section that deals with false, deceptive, or misleading.
I thought it was F.
No, F is unfair and unconscionable.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I was confused.
The structure is the same, though, for those two sections. Yeah.
I think E and F, the structure's similar. I think E is far broader, Judge Cudahy. E says, I mean, it's as broad as you can get, debt collectors may not use any false, deceptive, or misleading representation or means in connection with the collection of
any debt. Well, it
regulates
the collectors. It doesn't say anything about consumers. It doesn't say anything about
No, it just says the collector's just not supposed to say it. Okay? And there is a distinction, Your Honor, between false statements. If it's false, it's false, it's false. And then you get to deceptive or misleading. So whether the consumer knew it was a false statement or was just patently false and ridiculous, the harm is in the false statement. Now, you may move to a deceptive or misleading statement and you may ultimately lose the case, but you don't need different standards. The issue is, have you stated a claim that they violated the law? Not, are you absolutely going to win it? I think if it's false, regardless of the effect on the listener, regardless of the intent of the speaker, it's actionable. And Congress has said no false statements.
It has to be a material falsehood, doesn't it?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
You put the wrong date on or something?
Well,
spell someone's name wrong?
That may be a falsehood that is not actionable practically because there's no damage amount.
No, I think when statutes punish false statements, they're invariably material. When you say false, deceptive, or misleading, you're trying to protect people. You don't have to protect them against immaterial falsehoods.
Well, I think the immaterial falsehoods, you're right, Your Honor. The immaterial falsehoods, I think, are kind of picked up just practically and also by the bona fide error defense. You make a mistake on the date, you know, the name's misspelled a little bit. I think it's picked up there. But I do see Your Honor's point. But if it's falsely claiming they can charge $15 a day to try to buffalo the consumer, or in this case, maybe buffalo the consumer's attorney.
Buffalo a lawyer, that's the issue.
And could. It could, but it's still a false statement. And it wasn't just some minor, you know, it's Tuesday, I thought it was Tuesday, and I told the consumer's attorney it was Monday. This is, goes right to the heart of the debt.
Even if the average lawyer would say, well, that's ridiculous, I don't believe it.
That's right, because Congress has given us a bright line which says you shouldn't make false statements.
Well, there's nothing in the statute about the standard to be applied, I don't believe. That's a matter of case law.
Well, the standard, you mean to what the effect is on the listener? I don't think you need to even go to the unsophisticated or...
You know what the problem is? The problem is, I mean, you're right. There's nothing about lawyers in E and F. And you can certainly, as I went on with Mr. Schoenberger, you can certainly imagine cases where you want to hit you don't want a lawyer exemption. But the fact is, Congress wasn't thinking about this problem. And it's very hard to say that Congress decided that there should be a single standard. So anything that would mislead an unsophisticated consumer is actionable, even if it was the letter was addressed to a lawyer.
And, Your Honor, that's right. When you get to the part in E of deception or misleading, you may wind up with a loser of a case. No one was deceived. No one was misled. But if it's a false statement, I mean, let's go with your vein. It's a materially false statement. I don't think it matters whether anyone was deceived or misled. You get into deception or misleading, that's the next case where we have to have surveys potentially, and you know those are $35,000.
But there is the settlement issue in this case too, isn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's we lost on a 12B6 motion, just like in the second group of cases. But that wasn't made to the lawyer. That was in a letter sent to the consumer.
Right, I understand. And that's an important point. I appreciate that. But suppose it were in a letter to a lawyer.
Sure.
Not to a consumer. Wouldn't a lawyer You have your argument that a consumer misunderstands, but a lawyer would know that a settlement offer is, you know, the first step in a dance and not to be taken seriously. Right.
I think that good consumer lawyers know that. I think that based on my experience, I know that. I don't know that all consumer lawyers know that, or all lawyers know that, Your Honor.
What worries me about that case is that I mean, maybe you want to discuss it in reference to the next cases, but certainly when you're making a settlement offer in a letter to a lawyer, these warnings that you want when they're dealing with a consumer seem really misplaced.
That's not my case. Well, it was my case, but I agree with what Your Honor said about G. I think that's a loser case where you maybe overshadow. That was one of our claims, and I think that's a loser case that I wouldn't bring again. I think that is a problem because one of the theories in Captain was this demand, there's a $15 penalty a day, would buffalo the consumer through the lawyer, to be overshadowed in their validation rights. And I think that's a loser. I think Your Honor's right when you're talking about are someone's rights being overshadowed. Okay, but I think it's a completely different case when it's an objectively false material statement.
That's going to buffalo the lawyer? Did I hear you say that?
I don't think it would. Okay.
Well, then why is it actionable?
That's what I'm saying, Your Honor. I think the G is a bigger problem. Where it's what kind of notices have to be given and are they overshadowed? I don't think that's a good case, and I think Your Honor has the panel has seized on a decent distinction, which is G. If you're trying to talk about overshadowing, I don't know that you can when you have the lawyer actually interposed as the intermediary. I think that's a problem, and I don't advocate that position. But where it's a harassment or abuse case. Under Section 1692D, where it's a false case under E, or where it's an unfair unconscionable under F, I don't think it matters who it went through. I don't think it matters if they called up one of your honors and started screaming at you to collect a debt from one of your neighbors, which is actually a debt collection technique. It's called plumbing the street. They get phone numbers around the consumer, and they call the neighbors and go, go tell Billy Bob to deliver a note telling that deadbeat to pay it up. Now, if it went to you, Your Honor, to go to one of your neighbors, one would think that you would probably be able to go, I don't think they can do that, and you might want to go see some consumer lawyer. You know, I'll leave you some of my cards later on if you want to give those referrals. But it's a, you know, I don't think it matters, because if we eliminated a bright line, you can't do it, we avoid that slippery slope of, did it go to a sophisticated federal judge? Did it go to a consumer lawyer who actually knows what they're doing? Did it go to one of your law clerks? Does it matter if they passed the bar or if they're waiting to pass the bar? Does it matter if they helped you write an opinion on a fair debt matter or not? Don't go down that slippery slope. You don't need to go there. I see my time is up, unless there's further questions. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Phillips. Mr. Hartzell?
Good morning, Your Honors. I guess I have the advantage of going last, so that means I have the least to say. It was interesting to hear Mr. Phillips concede that he doesn't have a 1692G claim, because that's the first time in this litigation I've heard that. This case was brought under 1692G, saying that this alleged communication from the debt collector to the FDCPA lawyer overshadowed the violation notice, and also that it was a 1692E claim, that it was false, deceptive, or misleading to allegedly have made this statement that $15 a day in interest would accrue. So it sounds to me like the G claim is gone. I wish he would have made that concession at the beginning. Would have saved us a lot of work. But even as to the E claim, let me go right to your question, Judge.
He said it was weak. I don't think he actually conceded.
Well, he said he doesn't advocate that position. But be that as it may, I would agree with him that it's pretty weak. In fact, I don't think it's even tenable. To go right to a question that you asked earlier, Your Honor, I think there has to be a blanket exception. I couldn't say it any better than Guerrero said it earlier this month, that once a lawyer represents the consumer, the lawyer, not the FTCPA, protects that consumer from the fraudulent, abusive, harassing
practices. Where does section D, E, and F say anything that could be construed that way?
Well, D, E, and F are just different forms of misconduct. The only place that the statute actually talks about
the activities of debt collectors.
Right.
The only place they're not limited very clearly that I can see.
The only place that the statute actually talks about the consumer's attorney is in 1692C2A, where it states that once you know that this consumer's got a lawyer, you have to deal with the lawyer. The reason for that is obvious. It's the same reason that prohibition exists in our own code of ethics, that the lawyer is there to protect the consumer. I'm not advocating up here. I'm not going down the path of saying we need to protect the lawyer. I understand your point, Your Honor, that we have to protect the consumer, but that's what the lawyer is there to do, protect the consumer. And I don't think that my 22-year-old debt collector sitting over here, even though he's trained in the FDCPA, is going to be able to buffalo the likes of Mr. Phillips or his other colleagues, and I don't think it happened here. If you remand this case, what we are going to have is a trial where the consumer is not even going to testify, doesn't even need to be there. I'm going to cross-examine Mr. Phillips' co-counsel, Mr. Halbert, who is apparently the recipient of this alleged statement, and we're going to talk about whether he was deceived or misled.
You know, the lawyer does the protection, but suppose you're represented by a lawyer and I'm the debt collector and I send you a dunning letter bypassing the lawyer. That's not permitted.
Correct.
But that's inconsistent with your theory that once a person has a lawyer, it's the lawyer who protects him.
Well,
because
no.
If I'm represented, I'll say I got this threatening letter, but I turn it over to my lawyer and he says, don't worry about it.
No, let me clarify, Judge, because I'm not going that far. There can be situations where the consumer has a lawyer. It does not totally insulate.
And, of course, one of those situations is when the debt collector makes a false statement to the lawyer, which, because it's some factual assertion, the lawyer isn't in a position to or is unlikely to be able to counter. And so he becomes a conduit for the false statement to his client.
Well, then we're back to Judge Williams' problem. What standard do we use? The unsophisticated lawyer standard or the
average lawyer standard, right? I mean, look, in tort law, we make a distinction between the standard of care required of the average person and of a trained person, a professional. So similarly, we could say, well, there's a standard of care of a professional, of a lawyer. And if it's a communication calculated to deceive a lawyer, despite his professional training, then it should be actionable. Well, what's wrong with that as a standard?
Well, I'm not sure that an average lawyer standard would be the appropriate standard.
We do with tort law. If you ask, for example, if you have a malpractice suit against a doctor, you ask, what is the standard of care in that doctor's specialty?
Correct.
Right? And similarly, and of course we confront this all the time with ineffective assistance of counsel. So suppose the debt collector makes a factual claim that's false about the debtor. Is the lawyer required? What kind of investigation? Does he have to investigate every suggestion? What if the letter says, your client has declared bankruptcy 10 times over the last 30 years? Like that.
Well, that's an easy one, because anybody can go to Pacer and find those. I would suggest that if it were me, this is a principal part of my practice. Okay, so the standard that would apply to me is different than the standard that would apply to that gentleman that was up here earlier arguing the gun transport case. Okay, just like it is with doctors or other medical professionals. So again, we could make that rule. We would have to create a separate standard for lawyers. I'm not sure exactly what that would be, or whether it would just devolve, Your Honor, into a completely subjective standard. And then because the Guerrero dissent, as Judge Kuthi pointed out, that's kind of where the dissent was going there, but they didn't really articulate.
The settlement offer, right? If the settlement offer is addressed to a lawyer, presumably the lawyer understands the settlement process. It's just the opening gambit, and a counteroffer is expected, and the settlement offer might be extended, renewed, and so on. Lawyer knows that. That's the sort of thing that the lawyer knows, I think, and a consumer doesn't. So that would be a pretty easy way of dealing with apparently an important class of cases.
I think so in that respect, yes. I think that is a easy example of why the communication should not be actionable on the basis of it being sent to the lawyer. I concede there are gradations here. I mean, you can take this, but we end up doing it, I'm afraid, on a case-by-case basis. We look at, well, how false, how misleading, how deceptive was this? How hard was it for this lawyer to be able to discern that this was just...
You have to ask all those questions in the ordinary case when you're talking about unsophisticated... Why is it somehow simpler to talk about an unsophisticated consumer than to talk about, say, the average lawyer?
Because I don't think there is an average lawyer when we're talking about...
Well, there isn't an average consumer either.
No, there's not. We don't use that standard. We use a much different standard. We use the least sophisticated or the unsophisticated consumer standard.
No, we don't use the least sophisticated consumer. That's just words. Least sophisticated consumer would be like a six-year-old or something, or a retarded person, or someone who doesn't know English language. That's not the standard.
Well, the standard is clearly not the average consumer. It is something less than that.
Well, unless you think the average consumer is unsophisticated in financial matters, especially the average consumer who gets into the position where he's receiving communications from debt collectors.
Judge, I would be happy to do away with the standard altogether and determine it on a case-by-case basis. Let's see who we're dealing with. Are we dealing with a federal appellate judge? Are we dealing with a law professor? Or are we dealing with a grade school dropout? I mean, I'm happy to do that. We can have every case decided on that purely objective basis of what are the qualifications or the characteristics of the recipient?
Approach. The cases are too small for that. So you use a, it's a very broad brush sort of thing. But you can have a broad brush lawyer standard along with a broad brush unsophisticated consumer standard.
You could. I do not disagree with that. You could. I think it would be difficult to arrive at what that standard is. Look at what it took to arrive at look at all the cases about the least sophisticated consumer, the unsophisticated consumer standard. I think it would be even more complex here with lawyers. And we would literally be driving down into what are that lawyer's particular qualifications, understandings, trainings, and so on and so forth. There's a big difference between Mr. Phillips and some other lawyers. There's a difference between myself and other lawyers who might be the recipient of that. I would arguably be held to a higher standard.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Hartzell. And Mr. Phillips, do you have anything further? Or do you want to wait till the next case? Or? Okay, fine. Okay, fine. Well, we'll